It's time for our monthly check-in on the latest science news with Gemma Tarlak. This month, we're learning about how 3-million-year-old stone tools are challenging ideas about our evolutionary timeline and more.
Gemma Tarlak is a senior associate editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us every month to talk about some of the coolest headlines in the science world. Gemma, thanks for joining us again.
Hi, great to be here. But wait, I want to hear about that marriageable men shortage. Well, that explains so much.
Stick around for 20 minutes. Maybe call in, too. Who knows?
Okay, you're on.
There's a lot of interest in that particular segment.
Yes, definitely. Well, so these tools, right? Three million-year-old stone tools. Where do we find these?
3.3 million year old. That 0.3 is super important. They're 3.3 million years old, and we found them in the Turkana Basin, which is kind of in northwestern Kenya. And one of the things I love about the story is how they were found. Basically, you had this paleoarchaeology team from Stony Brook University tooling around, you know, in their Land Rover looking for a specific site that they'd identified. They made a wrong turn. They got lost. They get out of their vehicle and, like, climb to higher ground to kind of figure out where the heck are we. And one of them said, hey, wait a minute, these rocks look kind of interesting. And that's actually how they found it.
Wow.
The rocks were the tools. It's crazy.
Well, so how do they know that these aren't just sort of weird-looking rocks? These are 3.3 million-year-old tools. Do they still look like, you know, things that would be recognizable to a trained eye?
To a trained eye, absolutely. To an electron microscope, absolutely. But, you know, to you or me, kind of looking around, no, we probably would think they were rocks. But they can tell because, you know, quite frankly, if you take a rock and hit it with another rock, it's going to chip off differently than if a rock just fell on top of it and chipped it. So they can really tell by going in there microscopically and looking at how things actually chipped off. And they were able to establish that 3.3 million year date because they were actually in layers that were partially exposed in an eroding creek bed. So kind of the creek bed was eroding vertically, if you could think about it, kind of eroding out, getting wider, and it was exposing the layers that they were able to date very precisely.
Now, I know Craftsman and Stanley say their tools last a long time, but they weren't around 3.3 million years ago. So who or what made these things?
That's the intriguing thing, because for a long time, we have thought our genus, Homo, that was the only genus capable of making tools. And the problem is, the oldest fossil we have that belongs to our genus is only 2.8 million years old. So, hey, there's about 500,000 years in there that makes the tools older than our genus. So the question is now, has the Homo genus actually been around a lot longer, like long enough to make those 3.3 million year old tools? Or was one of our predecessors, the Australopithecines, were one or more of those species able to do what, you know, we thought only us hotshot homos could do?
And so how do we answer that question?
We go looking for fossils. You know, let's hope we find more fossils and more definitive clues. And they're going to continue to look in that area. But meantime, there's another study by another team in a lab, you know, far, far away up in England, who actually figured out that it might have been possible for Australopiths to make tools. And they did it in a really interesting way. They figured out that our human hand bones have a certain density in a certain spot in response to repetitive stress, including making tools. So they found some Australopithecines had that same density in their hand bones, and they think that might mean that they were making tools as well. So it's a big question mark. It's the $60 million question. And gosh, I hope they find the answer because it's just tantalizing.
Talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, our monthly look at some of the most intriguing stories from the world of science. In your latest edition, Gemma, an interview with a woman who's helping people who live downstream from us here in Wisconsin, down in the Mississippi Delta, dealing with pollution.
Yeah.
Tell us about this.
This is such a wonderful story. This woman, her name is Wilma Subra, and she's a 70-something grandma. And, you know, when you see her in the pictures, you just have this image of her being this, like, super sweet librarian or some such. And she is super sweet, but she's a chemist and microbiologist who offers her services free to poor communities who are living in basically toxic neighborhoods. And those neighborhoods and communities have become toxic for a variety of industrial pollution reasons. She goes in, she shows them how to test the water cheaply, she helps them organize the data, and she also makes presentations speaking to folks on Capitol Hill, folks at the UN, anyone who will listen to her, and she's really an advocate for them, and it's such a fantastic story. She's done great work.
She sounds kind of like Erin Brockovich for the Mississippi Delta. So what kind of results has she had in helping people help themselves and figure out if their region has been polluted?
Yeah, you know, it's hard to even summarize the results she's gotten because she's been involved in over 800 projects. But, for example, she stopped a site from being constructed in a place called Mossville because the place was already highly polluted, highly contaminated. She helped folks who were affected by the BP oil spill, the cleanup crews. She helped educate them about you really got to wear the gloves, you really got to wear the face masks. These are carcinogens that you're dealing with. She has just done, I could list a whole book, really, of projects she's done in refinery communities that really helps people either get compensation or get relocated. And a lot of times what she does is just help people establish a link between physical symptoms and diseases that they have because of the pollution and the pollution itself. You know, industrial pollution sources have a long history of saying, no, it's just, it's coincidence that you're sick. It has nothing to do with the pollutants we're putting in your water, you know? So she really goes in and proves really that there is a link, and it's great work.
And you mentioned that she teaches people to do their own chemistry sampling, things like that. So it sounds like an intersection here between activism and citizen science.
Yeah, apparently, to one of these sites, she brought around these buckets that collected air samples and helped the folks living there learn how to use. They were, you know, rigged buckets that had special filters and things, but they were very affordable. They were very easy to use. She trained them to keep diaries so that they could sort of make sure that they were collecting samples and they were experiencing physical problems. And yeah, she's a fantastic educator and advocate. It's kind of the best thing of science. You know?
And we're going to wind up with a story about a new biodegradable drone prototype out there. A lot of crazy words altogether, but it's true. How does that work?
Okay, let me just tell you how crazy this thing is. They waterproof it by adding a protein found in paper wasp saliva that makes the paper wasp nests water repellent. Okay, this is the crazy, fantastic out-of-the-box thinking that NASA biologist Lynn Rothschild and her students are doing out in California. This is a prototype. Some parts are further along than others, but eventually they want to make this biodegradable drone that could be used in scientific research, and if it crashes, it's not going to damage the environment it crashes into, and they may even program it to crash so that, you know, they don't have to worry about creating a carbon footprint, stomping in there to pick up the drone, which is really neat. So the idea is it'll crash, it'll biodegrade, and there will be, you know, that old saying, take only photos, leave only footprints. Mm. There won't even be footprints left behind.
So I could see this being used in a remote, environmentally sensitive area where you don't want people, as you say, tromping in or having exhaust fumes. Is that what they're envisioning this to be used for primarily?
Yeah, absolutely. They're hoping to. And in fact, it was inspired because she was involved in a project in Alaska where they were studying salmon in kind of a, you know, remote protected area. And the drone crashed, and fortunately they were able to recover it without the fuel tank rupturing or anything. But just the fact that it crashed into those pristine waters made her think, wait a minute, we need to think of something better so that we can avoid contaminating the very environment that we're trying to study.
So this is a prototype. How long until this thing is more widely available?
Well, like I said, some parts are already done. They're already ready to go. But there are bits and pieces. They're looking, for example, for a fully biodegradable motor design. They haven't worked all of that out. But they plan on having a bacterial fuel cell for it to provide electricity. There are a couple things that work on their own, but they have not been integrated yet into the actual working prototype. But she doesn't have a you know, timeline for it, but I bet you in the next 3 to 5 years we're going to see it take flight.
And you mentioned that idea of wasp saliva inspiring the waterproof technology on this thing. Is this a common thing, people turning more and more toward biology, toward the natural world to inspire a human technology?
Oh, I I think so, definitely. In a lot of ways, you're seeing, you know, for example, there are a lot of nanotechnologies, you know, those teeny tiny robots that function together and move like insects, for example, because they've been inspired by the way insects move and swarm. And we're seeing more and more of that. And it's, to me, it's one of the most fascinating areas of science.
Well, Gemma, it's been fascinating as always. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
That was Gemma Tarlak, Senior Associate Editor at Discover Magazine, based in Waukesha. She joins us every month for the stories behind the top science headlines.